Move on here. Our next speaker is Jim Leary. Jim Leary is the director of the folklore program here at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He researches, writes, and does media productions on the traditional music of the Upper Midwest. And today he's going to be talking to us about Alan Lomax and Alan Lomax's travels in this part of the country.
If you wait just a second, I've got to set up some cassettes here with the technician, and then we'll be off and running.
If we can take our seats again, I think Jim's all set to go.
Thanks, Jim. Title of my talk is Fieldwork Forgotten or Alan Lomax Goes North. In 1946, folklorist Richard Dorson spent 5 months roaming the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, straying briefly into northern Wisconsin to discover what he would call one of the richest storytelling regions in the United States. The preface to his book about the Upper Peninsula, Bloodstoppers and Bear Walkers, exclaimed, quote, "The abundance and diversity of oral traditions I found still stagger me." While Dorson's writings have made this northern United States region's wealth of verbal traditions well known, at least among folklorists, its similarly abundant and diverse musical traditions have remained relatively obscure, despite the fact that they were documented extensively 8 years earlier. From August through October 1938, Alan Lomax traversed northern Wisconsin, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and lower Michigan, recording an astounding number and variety of songs and tunes for the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress. In the 1939 report of the Librarian of Congress, Lomax wrote, "A 2.5 month reconnaissance survey of folk music in Michigan brought into the archive a group of about 1,000 songs, lumberjack, lake sailor, Irish, Southern Negro, Finnish, Serbian, Polish, Canadian, French, German, Hungarian, and Croatian." And while Lomax neglected to mention also Slovenian and Ojibwe French or Métis performers that he encountered, he echoed Dorson's grand assessment of what locals dub DUP, or the Upper Peninsula. "The Upper Peninsula of Michigan," this is quoting Lomax, "proved to be the most fertile source of material. After 6 weeks of recording a mass of lumberjack, Finnish, and French folk songs, I felt that there was material enough in the region for years of work. Near Newberry, Munising, Greenland, and Ontonagon, it was comparatively easy to find lumberjack singers. Everywhere through the Copper Country," that's the Keweenaw Peninsula around Houghton and Hancock, "in that area and south of it, Finnish singers generously furnished me with more materials that I had time to record. And in Champion and Barriga, I found French ballad singers who still enjoy ballad fests that lasted all night." Unfortunately, Alan Lomax never returned to the region, nor has anyone else undertaken the years of work, Lomax said, that the material demanded. Although, as we'll see, I've been able to establish or to scatter about half a year's work in the region, fieldwork, over the last 20 years. Now, some of Lomax's recordings from this excursion have been issued and even reissued, notably on Songs of the Michigan Lumberjacks, a now out of print LP in the Library of Congress series, also on the Library of Congress's American Fiddle Tunes, about to be, I believe, reissued on CD by Rounder Records, and this includes a couple of tunes by Donegal-derived Irish-American fiddler Patrick Bonner from Beaver Island, Michigan. And then Michigan State University Press also came out recently with Beaver Island House Party that has more tunes by Patrick Bonner, as well as a couple of other people that Lomax recorded in the 30s, who he called two remarkable Irish singers, Dominic Gallagher and Johnny Green. Yet with the exception of these few Irish fiddle tunes and Anglo-Irish ballads of Great Lakes and lumber camps, Lomax's 1938 work remains obscure, largely outside the ken of folk song and tune cognoscenti, and certainly beyond the pale of public recognition. Even as, at the century's end, the pioneering work of folklorist, ethnomusicologist, and sound recordist Alan Lomax is being rightly honored by the massive, well-annotated reissue of his field recordings of traditional music by Rounder Records. These landmark recordings in the northern upper Midwest still languish. So my main tasks today are to bring them to light and to suggest why they've been largely forgotten. But before launching into a sonic travelogue that links Lomax's 1938 journey with my own several decades later, as well as before concluding with speculations and perhaps a hardcore regionalist rant about fieldwork forgotten since I was born up in this region, up in northern Wisconsin, I'd like to offer, for those who might need familiarizing, just a little bit of background on the Archive of American Folk Song and on Alan Lomax, and this may be unnecessary, but I'll be brief. The Archive of American Folk Song, now the Archive of Folk Culture, was established at the Library of Congress in 1928 by Robert Winslow Gordon, a Harvard-trained ballad scholar with a grasp of recording technology, a knack for promoting American folk song through the popular press, and the moxie to secure private funds in support of field recording. Gordon was succeeded in 1933 by John Avery Lomax, a Texan, another Harvard-educated ballad scholar, one who'd written the classic cowboy songs and other frontier ballads with a preface by Theodore Roosevelt, published in 1910. Now, born in Austin, Texas in 1915, John Lomax's son Alan was a teenager when he assisted his father in 1933 on their first recording trips for the Library of Congress. And soon he was undertaking excursions of his own that included the first recordings of such celebrated traditional performers as Leadbelly, Woody Guthrie, Aunt Molly Jackson, and Muddy Waters. He went on to produce, this is Alan, and collaborate on an extraordinary array of books, films, radio and television programs, sound recordings that have shown the way and set the standards for contemporary public folklorists. A 7-page illustrated timeline and curriculum vita issued in 1998 by Rounder Records to promote its forthcoming and now out, in large part, Alan Lomax collection, lauds the man's extraordinary career. The words Michigan and Wisconsin and the phrase French Canadian and lumberjack songs do appear once in the extensive Rounder materials. Now, the impetus for Alan Lomax's northern exposure remains unclear, but it's certainly at the margins of his other work. In part, I suspect he wanted some northern instances of Anglophone balladry to flesh out the compendia he was publishing with his father. Our Singing Country came out in 1938, and Folk Song USA came out in 1946, and these were precursors of Alan's own Folk Songs of North America, which was published in 1960. In this regard, and as Lomax's field report of 39 acknowledges, he was assisted by Professors Ivan Walton of the University of Michigan and by Earl Clifton Beck of Michigan State Teachers College, who had already done in the 1930s considerable field work on Great Lakes and Lumber Camp singers, respectively. And his acquaintance with at least some of the non-Anglo-Celtic performers likely came from Howard Newsom, who was the director of the Federal Writers Project in Michigan, and his state guidebook prominently treated the Presque Isle Polish community of Posen that I'll get to in a little while. But even so, I have the distinct impression that although he came to know, to cite his recent National Book Award title, although he came to know the land where the blues began like the back of his hand, Alan Lomax up north was never quite sure where he was. File cards in the Library of Congress place him in several non-existent places, including Mietz, Michigan, N-I-E-T-Z, rather than Metz, M-E-T-Z. And likewise, years later, the multicolored map Names and places in the saga of American folk song that graces the interior cover of Folk Songs of North America has only one entry in Wisconsin, and actually it's Northfield, Minnesota, the site of the James and Younger Gang's ill-fated bank robbery placed right around where we are here in Madison. This error was compounded with blissful, blithe, inner beltline ignorance by the Smithsonian Institution through a massive cartographic enlargement affixed to a barn wall for at least a few souls to discover in the regional America area of 1976's summer-long bicentennial Festival of American Folklife. I worked there all summer during that 12 weeks, and every time I saw it, it drove me out of my mind. 5 years later, in 1981, I first stumbled unwittingly onto Alan Lomax's Northern Trail while organizing a regional traditional ethnic component of the otherwise folk song revival-dominated North Country Folk Festival in Ironwood, Michigan. A Finnish woman I'd interviewed introduced me to an elderly Slovenian in-law, John Schaubitz, who, although no longer the player of his youth, showed enough flash on piano accordion to suggest that he'd really been something once. Schaubitz told me he'd made records for the Library of Congress, and eventually I discovered, in Dick Spotswood's invaluable ethnic recordings in America, that Schaubitz was in there. Of course, he was misidentified by Lomax. He was called Schaubitz, and it did show, though, that he'd indeed recorded four pieces for Alan Lomax on the accordion in Bessemer, Michigan on October 8th, 1938. And some of this, there are other excerpts on his field recordings I've listened to that suggest that he was a little confused by these linguistic barriers. There's one where he asks Alex Kanya what his name is, or Felix Kanya, and Felix says, "Felix Kanya." And then he says, what is your name in Polish? And he says, Felix Kanya. I mean, it almost reminds me of the time I recorded some jokes in Polish and toast from a storyteller in central Wisconsin a few years ago, Max Chabotowski, and he was amazed that my tape recorder understood Polish. In the mid-1980s, while doing research for fieldwork for Michael Lokinen's film Medicine Fiddle regarding Métis fiddling and step dancing in the upper Midwest, northern Ontario, and Manitoba, I again crossed Alan Lomax's Northern Trail. And back in 38, 8 days after recording John Schaubitz, he was 40 miles west in Odena, Wisconsin, recording an Ojibwa fiddler, a lumber camp, and mill worker, Joe Cloud, who was sometimes accompanied by his four-string banjo-playing son, Clarence. Searching for eloquence and drama, and here we'll have the cassette in a second, the 23-year-old Lomax offered this introduction.
Ego.
Okay, in addition to this serviceable rendition of the classic fiddle tune Devil's Dream, Joe Cloud also played the White River Two-Step, the Red River Jig, and what he called a squaw dance. Lomax left no other information beyond the names of the players, the date, the place, the tunes themselves, and his on-disc comments. Yet this was, for me, a great find. The tune ascribed to the devil correlated with French Indian and, of course, more widespread legends regarding the fiddle as the devil's instrument. And stories about fiddling and the devil and devils at dances are still very common in the upper Midwest among Métis and Ojibwe people. And, of course, this tune also invoked simultaneously older native traditions of receiving songs from powerful and sometimes dangerous spirits. The White River Two-Step and the Red River Jig exemplified ongoing patterns of ancient animistic praise songs carried over into fiddle tunes like Whitefish on the Rapids and Tequamanon River Breakdown that I also subsequently recorded in the late 1980s from Métis fiddlers. Indeed, the tune Red River Jig, derived from a Quebecois fiddle tune, persists as the most prominent Métis fiddle tune across Canada and the United States northern tiers, inspiring performers to meld European step dancing with the mimetic hunting moves of native men's dances. Likewise, the squaw dance proved to be a women's dance and part of a dance typically done to the powwow scene's big drum, but rendered by Joe Cloud on the fiddle. And I was able subsequently to play it for several Ojibwas and a Menominee who recognized it immediately as a drum song. And we'll hear a little bit of that. After some phone calling and letter writing, I eventually tracked down Joe Cloud's granddaughter, Virginia Cloud Carrington, in Ashland, Wisconsin, to learn that Cloud was one of 17 children born in Hollow Lake, Wisconsin, and several of his siblings, as well as, of course, himself, took up the fiddle after their father, who was also a fiddler, and he was named Minagwaneash Anaquad, and Anaquad means cloud in Ojibwe, so he was given the English name of George Cloud, and he too had played hybrid tunes, these tunes that melded Ojibwe and French and Irish lumber camp kinds of repertoires. Well, inspired by these discoveries and what they have to say about so many issues, the musical culture of the upper Midwest, the nature of North American fiddling, the syncretism of woodland, Indian, and European traditions, I was moved to look more systematically into Alan Lomax's 1938 recordings. And fortunately, by the late 1980s, the Michigan Traditional Arts Program at Michigan State University had begun to offer me periodic fieldwork contracts to survey the Wolverine State's traditional music, past and present. In 1989, I traveled to the Polish stronghold of Posen, and 2 years later, I visited the French community of Baraga. And let me elaborate a little on both communities, wrapping my own discoveries around the scant documentation but rich performances Lomax provides. And really, I was able to find pretty much nothing about these communities from Lomax's materials beyond what's actually on the discs, a few index cards, and then his little reports that I've quoted to you all already. A little bit about Posen here. In the early 1870s, poles from Posen and Kashubia were lured by lumber companies to Presque Isle County, Michigan. There they cleared rocks, stumps, and slashings from cut-over acreage and established farms to grow rye and potatoes. They worked winters in the woods and labored in the limestone quarries on the nearby shores of Lake Huron. Some of their near neighbors were Anglo-Americans, but more were Low Germans, the Prussians and Pomeranians, with whom they'd rubbed shoulders in Europe. Their relative isolation, rural occupation, and general conservatism, combined with a regular influx of fellow immigrants escaping Pennsylvania coal mines and Chicago factories, to help them maintain many features of old world culture well into the 20th century. Conrad Berkovici, an immigrant journalist, visited Posen in the early 1920s. The United States had recently restricted immigration. The prohibition legislation enacted by Pious Wasps was in place. The Ku Klux Klan and other touts of 100% Americanism were gaining influence, and there was considerable public debate concerning the value of, quote, foreigners within the American fold. Berkovici, and of course especially Slavs, Jews, Italians, and so forth. Berkovici tried to counter this by stressing the intrinsic worth of old world customs while championing the immigrant contribution to American life. And he observed, quote, the Pole is a very good farmer and a very good cattleman, but he believes in doing things as his father and grandfather did them. He too believes in small farm villages instead of a baronial estate for each farmer, as was Thomas Jefferson's original dream. Quote from Berkovici. A decade later, the Federal Writers Project workers who produced Michigan, A Guide to the Wolverine State, emphasized only the archaism of a community that had preserved, quote, intact its Polish culture, unquote, and therefore was, quote, the delight of ethnologists. They were particularly struck by the vigorous celebration of life cycle rituals, especially weddings. Quote from the guidebook, dinner for the wedding is provided by the father of the bride. The father of the groom supplies the musicians. Each male guest contributes to the bride's dowry in the ceremony of breaking a plate. A china plate is placed on the table in the middle of the room where general dancing is in progress. And then at a specified time, men threw silver dollars against the plate. When a plate was broken, the bride danced with the thrower and kept the money. And marriage festivities continued for 3 days and three nights. And this was very common in Wisconsin, too. The chroniclers unaccountably ignored the essential participation of women who prepared substantial traditional meals and through a cycle of mournful songs admonished the bride about the toil and anguish of married life, typically giving her a little babushka and a broom as kind of a symbolic ceremony. And the guidebook's terse references to sustained dancing, meanwhile, only hinted at the contributions of a tireless corps of musicians with rich repertoires, who the people who kept the dancers going for 3 days and three nights. But Posen's Polish musicians have been turning up in the printed historical record since about 1900, although they've been active, of course, since the 1870s. From roughly 1908 till the early 1930s, a fellow named Philip Lewandowski played violin along with, this is a quote from a local history, Cash Lewandowski, who also played the violin, and Walter Pilarski, who was the drummer. The trio traveled to Roger City Mets and Hawks and around the country, usually by the familiar horse and buggy to play for the famous 2 and 3 day weddings. Felix Kania and Anthony Strzelecki were slightly younger than Lewandowski, and both men were born in Poland in the 1880s, both established farms in Posen, Michigan in the early 20th century. Felix Kania, a clarinetist and also a fine singer, typically teamed up with a pair of violinists and a drummer to play for local weddings, while Anthony Strzelecki, who had learned fiddling by ear from his father Jacob, often teamed with his brother Walter, who bowed chords on the bass fiddle. Up until the 1950s, such men regularly escorted Posen wedding parties to and from the church with stately marches, and amidst the wedding dance held in an empty barn or on a tent-covered outdoor platform, they favored crowds with polkas, waltzes, and such forms as the Oberek, the Krakowiak, and the Kujawiak. But the supposedly intact culture that was the delight of ethnologists had been slowly evolving since the 1870s. These musicians, like their fathers, also played Herr Schmidt, a specialty dance of their German neighbors. They played a handful of American pop tunes, and even a larger share of square dance melodies acquired from the region's Anglo-Celtic settlers and also Anglo-Canadian settlers as well. Tunes like Devil's Dream, The Irish Washerwoman, Turkey in the Straw, and Weevily Wheat. When Alan Lomax recorded the wedding bands of Felix Kania and Anthony Strzelecki in the late 1930s, he was most fascinated by the mixture of old world and new world sounds, and he wrote, a visit to Posen, Michigan brought the library an interesting collection of Polish ballads and fiddle tunes. Many of the latter had been learned from local, and by this he meant Anglo-Celtic fiddlers. In a lot of cases, they didn't get there any sooner, but I guess from his perspective, they were local and the other people were new arrivals. But at any rate, he mentions this kind of crossover. In other words, although Lomax found thoroughgoing Polish songs and tunes, He also heard fiddlers bow square dance pieces in a syncopated improvisatory musical dialect that wed the Wieszka or village orchestras of rural Poland to the string band tradition of British America. Well, here are a couple of little pieces. First, Felix Kania and Tony Wyszynski with a Polish tune called that they called The Lice That Ate the Pants.
I wonder if those pants-eating lice live in the lumber camps. Alan Lomax noted that the Posen fiddlers also play square dance tunes, learned in lumber camps and rural neighborhoods from Yankees and Anglo-Canadians. But the Polish versions remain steeped in the old country style. Let's hear Turkey in the Straw with an old-time Polish accent.
Richard March is going to be talking tomorrow, I think, some about the Down Home Dairyland radio series that he and I co-produce and Richard continues to do. And this is a little segment we did on this Polish fiddling. I want to give you a few other little samples from this area. Lomax mentioned many ballads sung back in 1989. I was able to meet a fellow named Sylvester Rommel who learned many songs from his mother, who's repertoire, he numbered it about 100 ballads, and they used to sing around the house and while milking cows. And in the 30s, Lomax recorded not only his mother, but Sylvester himself singing a number of songs with his brothers, who were now deceased. And when I played back a particular piece, it was kind of a moving piece. It was about about the immigration experience, about a Pole who'd come over from the old country, was working in a factory in Chicago, and the foreman was goddamning him all the time, and he was writing back to his wife that he would never, to find someone else, he would never be able to find the money to bring her back. And I played him this recording, and as I did, he began to sing along with it 51 years later, and then he was very moved by it. I want to play also, I mean, I don't have that queued up, but I have a little bit of Felix Kania, the clarinet player's, singing a song about a drunkard, and we'll hear just an excerpt of that. Play one more excerpt here that echoes "Turkey in the Straw." It's actually a song that Gene Autry popularized over the WLS Barn Dance, which of course covered the Upper Midwest, broadcast out of Chicago beginning in the 1920s and continuing for several decades. And this is a song called "Gold Mine in the Sky" that's sung by two Polish sisters with harmonies that are really in keeping with their Polish singing. So it's one of these kind of syncretistic performances. We'll hear just a little of that.
Thank you.
Okay, that's a little glimpse of Poe's, and I want to give a little glimpse of Berriga, Michigan. And this is in the Upper Peninsula on a little bay of Lake Superior, just a little bit to the southeast of the Copper Country. French Canadians, mostly from Quebec, entered Berriga County again in the 1870s, like the Poles and Posen, to work in the woods and sawmills and to farm. A large contingent settled in Section 12 near Berriga. Several roads, notably Belair Road and Cadjo Road, and those names will come up again in a minute, indicate their presence. A local history of ethnic groups in Berriga County suggests that the French settlers balanced work with play. Here's a quote, "As with the voyageurs of old, hard times and little money did not stop them from having a gay time occasionally. Most of them loved to get together, laugh, talk, sing, and dance to a fast fiddle." And certainly that was the case when Alan Lomax visited the area in 1938. Janine Belair Pelto and her sister Marie Belair Tottenen, who I was able to interview, and especially, they both remember Alan Lomax's visit. Although he was married at the time, his wife wasn't traveling with him, and one of these women later wrote to me that she used to go with Alan in the 1930s, one of many legends that I've heard about him that I probably won't get into in this talk. But at any rate, apparently Lomax and a group of singers and musicians traveled to several houses to make recordings, but the bulk of the recordings were made elsewhere, and Priscilla recollects that the songs were recorded in the Holmes Hotel in Berriga, which is now torn down. This is what she says. "Alan came over to the house and he talked to my folks, and Dad and Mother sang a few songs for him at our home. Then he asked them if they would sing for him at the hotel, and they agreed, so off we all went. There were other French people, too, who came to the hotel to sing." In all, Alan Lomax recorded more than 80 songs and fiddle tunes in roughly 3 hours of performances, from Mose and Exilia Belair, Edward Cadjo Sr., John and Matilda Cadjo, Fred Foucault, Edward King, originally Roy, Delia LeClaire, Joe Miron, and Adlor Vizina. Priscilla Belair Tottenen, Mose and Exilia's daughter, reckons some of her footwork also appears on the recordings, as she used to jig, or as she put it, tap dance to all of her mother's songs. The Belair sisters also recall that Lomax took most motion pictures in Berriga. And here I'd like to show a little excerpt that shows Mose and Exilia Belair singing with a little of their foot tapping, and a little boy is step dancing on a porch. And then we'll shift to a view of Edward King singing and tapping out the rhythm with his feet. He's improvising a New Year's song coming from typical custom in the area, where people used to go house to house and have parties and drinks and food to celebrate the New Year. So if we could have both the video and the tape, the cassette, simultaneously. These are the Belairs. And this is Edward King. Okay, you can stop that. You can fade forward. Now, perhaps because of the confusion of recording so many performances from so many people at several houses, and certainly, you know, I've had this experience often as a field worker, when you're the sound recordist, you're also filming, you're meeting a lot of different people, trying to get the names straight of the people, names of the tunes, you know, it's run the equipment and all that stuff. It's pretty tricky. I don't think Alan Lomax had too much trouble with most of the performers he recorded, as far as I know, however, but he certainly had trouble on this northern journey. When I was interested in the community, I actually wrote a letter to the hometown paper mentioning the names of people that Lomax had recorded, and I discovered subsequently that they almost all were wrong. Edward Cadjo is... He isn't listed as the fiddler at the session, but Fred Foucault, his name spelled like, I mean, nowadays everyone would know because of Michel Foucault, but you know, it's F-O-U-C-A-U-L-T, but Alan Lomax spelled it F-U-C-O. Delia LeClaire is dubbed Lila St. Clair. Joe Miron is called Joe Miror, and Adlor Vizina is given as Adlor Vini. So, you know, here I don't know again whether Alan Lomax set these down himself incorrectly, or whoever was doing the paperwork at the Library of Congress couldn't read his handwriting. I'm not really sure, but there was certainly some confusion. And unlike Alan Lomax, I was able to acquire biographies for all of the performers. According to descendants of the 1938 performers, French parties were very much enforced through the 1940s, especially, as I mentioned, during the New Year's, when families would visit from house to house for 2 weeks, and there people would sing songs, fiddle, jig, and square dance. While early in the century there was some antipathy between the French and the neighboring Finns, it did not last for long, and several of the performers had Finnish spouses with names like Tatinen and Gestila. By the early 1950s, specifically French parties began to dwindle, although kind of Creolized regional parties were very common, and French singing was part of celebrations for the extended family of Adlor Vizina until his death shortly after a big wedding celebration in 1981, and there are still people in that community, at least as of when I visited a decade ago, who still sing French songs. Well, this retrospective travelogue might be extended to include Finnish and South Slavic performers that Lomax also recorded, and I do have more information on them, but I think I hope I've piqued your interest sufficiently in the appeal and significance of this nearly forgotten music, and now I think it's time to take up speculations on just why Alan Lomax and so many more people who have otherwise combed and celebrated the Archive of American Folk Songs' remarkable holdings have all but left these recordings alone. Now, the first speculation center on Alan Lomax himself. Not everyone can do everything, and most of us who do research, despite veering off on occasional tangents, follow fixed trajectories. As a Southerner and a Westerner of Anglo-American heritage, but someone who was also grew up in Texas amidst strong African-American and Mexican Tejano kinds of communities, Alan Lomax was understandably fascinated by Anglo-American music, by Western music, by Southern music, including the musical traditions of African-Americans, Cajuns, Caribbeans, and Spanish-speaking peoples. He was fascinated by the fusions of all of these particular Southern Western elements in the Americas, and he also was intrigued by the connections between these American traditions and their old world hearths. So no wonder his northern trip was a kind of a sidelight and for him a once in a lifetime experience. But I'll be more daring about why these recordings were neglected by Lomax, inspired perhaps by the bold pronouncements that characterize his own writings. Contrary to northern-tending racist evolutionary notions of Aryan and Nordic military and scientific superiority that certainly took hold in the 19th century and whose influence is I think, still felt, contrary to these notions, which were commendably abhorred by the staunchly anti-racist and anti-fascist Lomax, pursuers of musical culture, like Lomax, have embraced an opposing environmental determinism, heading almost exclusively south to discover musical sensuality, passion, and power in these others, and in contrast to the folk musical traditions found in northern climes. So I think that's going on here as well. And then there is what we might call accordion phobia.
Now, besides John Shawbitz, who I mentioned further on in this film, there are some images of a Finnish accordion player, a Swede Finn, John Fredriksson from Calumet, playing a button accordion. And Lomax encountered many accordion players on this trip. Now, he also persistently has disdained the accordion, unless transformed by people of color and their neighbors, the black French or Creoles of Louisiana with their zydeco music, Cajuns, Haitians and other Caribbean people playing merengues and so forth, and Chicanos with the conjunto style, preferring that European Americans maintain more ancient musical traditions and referring to the accordion as, quote, this pestiferous instrument, unquote. Lomax has argued that, quote, during the 19th century, the accordion has done severe damage to the old folk music of Central Europe, unquote. Despite Alan Lomax's erstwhile solidarity with America's immigrant working class, and of course he was active in a number of popular front activities and so forth in the 30s and 40s, he likewise manifested the elitist's embrace of primitive, peasant, static, idealized folk culture and a disdain for anything evolving or worse yet, polluted by bourgeois popular culture. And of course, in 1938, the time that he ventured north, the jukebox hit Beer Barrel Polka, recorded by the Glahi Musette Orchestra, but also covered by the Schmaltzy Andrews Sisters, was topping America's pop charts, tainting all accordionists by association. And of course, that taint would continue in the post-war era as as rock and roll claimed the hearts and minds of American youth, and also Lawrence Welk began his kind of sugary, long-running pop music on TV that many falsely equated with the heart of polka music and accordion playing, which I would certainly argue is what Welk was doing was in many ways a departure from it. And then, of course, there are the old ruts of received scholarship or received folk song scholarship, the sort of intellectual Chisholm Trail that John Lomax, Alan's father, and others established. In 1888, for example, the first president of the American Folklore Society, William Wells Newell, opened the inaugural Journal of American Folklore with a statement on the field and work of a journal of American folklore. Newell saw the principal object of the American Folklore Society was linked to the publication of a journal of a scientific character, which would provide for the collection of fast vanishing remains of folklore in America. And he enumerated what he meant by this: relics of old English folklore, lore of Negroes in the southern states of the Union, lore of the Indian tribes of North America, lore of French Canada and Mexico. European Americans, not only recent immigrants, but also the abundant and musically influential longtime citizens of German heritage who've had an enormous effect on so-called hillbilly or country music and its evolution, were given no mention whatsoever, no place in the canon. And that's really continued. Hence, there's been no place in America's notion of folk music for regions like the Upper Midwest, where Anglo-Protestant people of European origins predominate. And finally, there's the ideology of consensus, embraced by the folk revival that was gaining force in the 1930s and is sustained in the simplistic and dominant wing of the current, but otherwise, I think, very laudable multicultural movement, that part that talks about American folk song, Native American folk song, Hispanic folk song, African or African American folk song, as if these people were all homogenized and undifferentiated. That sort of consensus force that we find in the folk song revival, for example, had little place for tricky little things going on in this region, like Ojibwas playing squaw dances on fiddles, or Poles singing in dual languages about both American factories and cowboy heavens, or no place for Slovenians playing the accordion. Certainly this was true in the late 1930s within the context of the federal government, and certainly within the context of the Archive of Folk Culture, about which the recently retired archivist Joe Hickerson observed, speaking in the 1930s, there was some reluctance to publicize the recordings of foreign language singers in the United States. Congressional philosophy was not strongly pluralistic, and the melting pot persuasion was prevalent. Now, I think that And Dick Spotswood and Chris Drakowitz, who are here, have done more than anyone, perhaps, to alter the public consciousness about the variety of musical strains in America. But it's disturbing to me that Dick Spotswood's extraordinary series issued for the Library of Congress during the bicentennial on folk music in America, which it included the full array of people making traditional music in America, is long out of print and in many ways all but forgotten. And likewise, Alan Lomax's Northern Sojourn remains fieldwork forgotten, except for a handful like myself who, despite complaints about its neglect, are nonetheless, given all the obstacles, astonished and profoundly grateful that it happened at all. Thank you. If I'm right about the clock, there might even be a few minutes for questions if anybody has or comments. Yes.
You know this literature much better than I do, but I would like to say that I agree that it's very hard to look at the work of Alan Lomax without seeing something that's very tempting to call racist.
Well, yeah, I think much of ballad scholarship, which and its influence is still felt here, came out of the work of Francis James Child at Harvard, who was a professor of modern languages and interested in English literature, and he put together the wonderful English and Scottish popular ballads. Of course, he had comparative notes in there from Scandinavia and throughout Europe, but it did have that particular emphasis and was taken in many ways as a canon. And certainly, Child's disciple at Harvard, George Lyman Kittredge, was the person who trained Robert Winslow Gordon, who set up the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress, and also John Lomax. And Alan Lomax spent a year at Harvard, although by then, Kittredge was long gone. But certainly that force is being felt. To Lomax's credit, and the credit of his father, although his father was very much more of a conservative, patriarchal Southern regionalist, but to their credit, they expanded that Anglo-American ballad strain to look especially at African-American musical traditions, and did fantastic work. I would argue that probably one could make the case for Alan Lomax as being what Norman Mailer called the white Negro, or having certain wannabe elements in there. Those are strong elements, I think, in the American cultural scene. This powerful attraction by non-African American people to that music for a whole array of reasons. I think that's going on, and I'm not really seeking necessarily to criticize at all what they've done, because what they've done is I think profound and extremely important, and we owe them a great debt. I guess what I'm trying to do is to point out what they didn't do. Not to say that they can do everything, but just to say that other people who followed in their footsteps have also not done it for a large part, and those who make pronouncements about what constitutes the canon of American music tend to look at it in terms of certain items that have certain kinds of ethnic cultural pedigrees, rather than looking at the whole creolizing process of the American experience, and how everyone who comes here creates music very quickly that is American music and ought to be considered in that fashion. Yes.
Well, I think that the other sort of problem is that what you're dealing with is that Lomax hit this gold mine of African American
Sure, but I would rather speak to Frankie Yankovic rather than Weird Al. And regarding Frankie, I would say that he is as important as Bill Monroe. He's as important as Valerio Longoria. He's important as Clifton Chenier. As many of these kinds of regional performers. They're all extremely important, and I think that none of them have had extraordinary mainstream success, but all of them have made extraordinary contributions to music, and I think that that Frankie needs to be counted. Weird Al, we can talk about it in other kinds of ways. I mean, I think he's interesting too. Yes. Yeah.
But also because he perhaps felt, along with many others, that these musics were going to be essentially transitory in their influence on American music in general, in any identifiable way, and that the various cultures that had spawned them were already intact in Europe and would be the proper study of European ethnomusicologists, so that he preferred to focus on the Afro-American.
Yeah.
Including my own, by country western music, so that what all happened to all of these various northern and central European musics gradually just became amalgamated into this generic commercial country malaise that overspreads the entire middle of the United States.
Sounds like you've been listening to the radio stations. Okay. I think you raised a number of real important points. I mentioned Lomax's fascination with regard to European Americans, with these older notions of pure static peasant kinds of society, and so he was comfortable roaming the hills of Tuscany or traveling around Spain and so forth. Of course, if you look and he even recognized this, if you look at the music that was going on there, he found that people were playing accordions there, and there were all sorts of creolizations going on. One can't look at flamenco, for example, without thinking of the many, many different strains, and some might say that's corrupt to have Sephardic Jewish and North African and maybe Celto-Iberian things all swirling around together. Some might call that corrupt, but he was he was content to see that as perhaps pure because it was over there. So, as you say he did have this notion in mind, I think, that there was this sort of golden age of peasant music that you could still find in certain places that was kind of static and beautiful and intact and all that, and perhaps he did view as I gather you do that in this region, things are hopelessly amalgamated and homogenized. See, I grew up in this region, so I have an entirely different perspective. Okay.
We simply have different perspectives.
Sure.
The word mongrelization would not be too strong.
Well, I guess I prefer.
Is that not, in fact, an inevitable tendency in an area with so many different small ethnic enclaves in which there is not enough time between initial immigration and the intellectual influences of the emerging mass media?
Well, this is an old model that people have talked about for many years, that the notion that mass media is going to destroy folk culture, and also the notion that the American experience results in rapid assimilation, and I I think those are powerful forces. There's no doubt that they're powerful forces, and we can point to many instances and say that, you know, this is what's going on. On the other hand, we can point to, I think, just as many instances where people have retained distinct cultural identities. You know, last night you heard a band playing Dutchman style music, which is an evolution of German bohemian music that came out of the 19th century. It's evolving. It has elements of swing in it, but it has, you know, it's very much a distinct musical, cultural, you know, regional style. And in this region, it's one of many styles that are designated as being German or Polish or Slovenian or what have you. So, you know, those kinds of things are going on, and also on a regional level where you have people of diverse ethnic backgrounds. You know, it's not, what happens is not just, you know, people listen to country western music, WLS in the 20s, and suddenly want to play like that. To some extent they do, but they also play with their neighbors who are from all different backgrounds, and a repertoire which has all kinds of you know, micro-regional variations, like, you know, micro-climatic ecospheres sorts of things. You know, I mean, that sort of thing happens, where you know, you find people who are playing really the whole musical stratigraphy of you know, all the musical traditions in their little micro-region. And I think that has not been recognized. Certainly it wasn't recognized by, you know, by Lomax, but I think it's very much a reality that one can call, you know, corrupt or tainted, but, you know, culture is constantly changing. Otherwise, it dies completely. You know, these old musical forms are not museum artifacts. They're living things, just like people are living. And I think that, I mean, I'm open to looking what's going on, and what I see going on, you know, I think is certainly different from what Alan Lomax saw or didn't see. I think it's probably we're at the time to take a break, and thanks all for your attention. Thanks, guys. Nice job.
Thanks. We'll take a quick break and start right back again at 10:30.